Hello and welcome to Dialect. I'm Tony Gosling. Dialect is Bristol's first podcast, set up with a grant from the Scarman Trust in 2002. Being broadcast on community radio stations in Preston, Swindon and St Albans, and we're on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. That's bcfmradio.com. This week, David Hempelman-Adams, explorer, is just back from the Arctic. His boat, Northabout, due in Bristol this week. Also, Sue Jones reports on how smart are smartphones and whistleblowers who've been turned into criminals. We're talking, of course, about the government child sex abuse inquiry. We hear from Sabine McNeil from victims-unite.net. Dialect's produced by volunteers. We're online at dialectradio.co.uk. And if you want to join in, contact the People's Republic of Stokes Croft or Volunteering Bristol. And I'll give those contact details at the end of the show.
Yeah, my name's David Hempelman-Adams, and I was the leader of a boat trip which went from Bristol all the way up to Murmansk, then went around the northeast and northwest passages down the coast of Greenland, and is currently just off the coast of Ireland now, and it will be coming back to Bristol next week.
Tell us about your, that trip is around the Arctic Circle. How awkward is that for a yacht to do?
The whole concept of, if you look at the Northeast Passage, which is a very long northern passage, a couple thousand miles off the Russian coastline, it used to take people a couple of years. They'd have to overwinter, and they would need ice strengthened boats or ships to do it. So it was extremely uncommon, actually, to try and do it in one season. And the skipper who was on that yacht with me actually overwintered because he didn't do it in one season. That was just the Northeast Passage. And the boat was built by some Irish guys, and that was 16 years ago. And they tried the Northeast Passage, and again, they were stuck and they had to overwinter. But what was...
When you say overwinter, do you mean the boat gets stuck and you've just got to stay there for months?
Well, it used to be like that. So the early explorers in the 1800s would actually have to overwinter, take a lot of provisions, such as Franklin on the Northwest Passage. He took two ships up and they overwintered. If you look at Abenson, who did the Northwest, he took three seasons to actually get through. But nowadays, if you've got the right weather information, the right ice information, you're always trying to not go from port to port, but you've always got hopefully a default position where you should be hopefully able to, if you do start to get stuck, or if you're late in the year, then you really want to get into port and get the boat lifted out.
But I know this isn't the first time it's been done. There was a Norwegian explorer did it, I think it's almost 10 years ago now.
2010. Well, that's how I got the idea. The guy called Borg Åsland and Torleif Torrensen. I met Borg back in 95-96 when we were both skiing to the South Pole, and he had this idea of actually going around the northeast and northwest in one season. And he actually invited me on his trip, and I said, "You'll never do it. There's no way could you do it." And they did it in a very, very small little catamaran, little plastic fiberglass catamaran, where you could pull the boat up on the ice so it wouldn't get crushed. And they actually managed to get around in one season. So that really was, that gave me the idea, because after they got around, of course, I sort of regretted not going with them. But that was a catalyst for the trip that we did this year. We went up last year as a shakedown cruise up to Spitsbergen, and this Irish boat did really, really well. We did a few modifications up in Sharpness, kept the boats in Bristol. Our home port is Bristol, and I think that worked out well, because it was a green city of Europe. So I think there was a good bit of synergy there. And what I'd like to do, the reason we brought it back, instead of keeping it in Greenland, is we want youngsters to come down and see it from the Bristol area.
Now, there is seems a bit of a fudge going on over global warming or climate change, whatever you want to call it, because the ice cap, the North Pole, is certainly melting. It doesn't necessarily look so bad as it is, because, of course, it can get thinner without you necessarily seeing it from space, for example. What's your take on it all?
Well, I'm not actually a scientist, and all I've tried to do is make people more aware of what's happening up in the Arctic. I first went up to the Arctic in 1983, and I've been going up probably every year since. So I've seen slow degradation of the environment, of the ice cap, of the permafrost, of people's how they live up in these places. So it's not an overnight thing. I've seen this slow, gradual change in the environment up there. And of course, you will get people who will say, well, this is natural. Greenland was green at one time. You had people who used to migrate right across the northern shores of Canada and, of course, Russia. So they would argue that this is common. The planet goes in these cycles. And, of course, they're right, absolutely right. But what I've seen in my lifetime is massive change very, very quickly. And again, of course, what happens is this just last week, I think this was the second or third lowest drop in ice in terms of volume. But there was a couple of professors who would say it would be by now this year completely ice free, and there wouldn't be any ice at the North Pole, and they were wrong. You know, we do know that there was a lot of ice up there. So of course, people then say, well, climate change can't be that bad because there is still ice. And I think it's just like the analogy I think is you've got a patient who is terminally ill. You're going to get lots of different doctors who are saying, well, we're not quite sure, maybe it's 6 months, or another guy will say, well, I think you've got 2 days. So you get a massive range of views. And of course, again, with the climate models now that they use, the massive computers, you get varying degrees. But what I think is certain is that they all agree there'll be no ice by sort of 2050. And actually, that's not very far away. And I think you'll get to a tipping point where, there's no comeback for it. And my frustration is simply, we don't seem to be doing anything about it. We talk about it. People, as I said, there was this one fellow who was a very good scientist, said he didn't think there would be ice in 2016. And because he got it wrong, people say, oh, well, then it can't be that bad. But the fact is, it is. And we just seem to skirt around it. So the whole of my trip was simply to try and make people more aware of the great scientists or the great science that's going on, with all the hundreds of scientists who are working on a daily basis, who are seeing these changes on a daily basis, and get people more aware of what's happening with our planet. And I just think, what if we are wrong? There might be people say, absolutely, there's no way this is going to happen. Well, but if we're right, or these scientists are right, what's the fallback?
What about the oil industry? Do you think they play a role? Because they certainly seem to be very interested in buying up all the new technologies that might replace oil, things like tidal power, a lot of investment in that kind of thing. And they do seem to own and control quite a lot of the alternatives to oil.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think if you look at the economics of it, because the price of oil was quite high at one time, that made exploration far more economical to go up into these Arctic oceans. So there was a lot of, as we know, Greenpeace went up to the Kara Sea, where they were drilling for oil. And a lot of these places now, if you look at Toyokatuk in northern Canada, they've been drilling oil around there, and for gas as well. But the problem is that with less ice, then you can drill in these very remote areas. But the ecosystem is so unbelievably fragile. If you had an oil explosion like happened in the Gulf of Mexico, you can have terrible, terrible problems, and you just wouldn't be able to clean it up because of the winter environment up there.
But David, my point is more really to do with, it seems like whatever's going on with climate change and the use of oil, that the industry that controls fossil fuel consumption at the moment, many people would say there's way too much of it, seem to also be controlling the alternatives and making sure that they don't really come charging in and our consumption of oil goes down.
Yeah, I think you're right. I mean, I think they are looking at alternatives. Certainly solar, certainly wind, certainly if you look at some of these companies and what they've got into. The thing that when you go back to the tar sands in Canada and fracking even, it's still burning carbon. If you look at Germany, because of the earthquake and the not using nuclear power, or they stop using, or they want to use, stop using nuclear power, they're just building bigger coal generating power station, which is completely the reverse of what we should be doing. And we should be looking at more tidal, we should be looking at alternatives. One of the great things about Iceland, for example, is the whole place, and of course we haven't got that climate or we haven't got those resources, but their whole country is run on natural resources. And if you look at Spitsbergen in Longyearbyen, there's it's a very small town, but they're nearly carbon neutral because they're able to capture the carbon in the chimneys and put it back into the mine. So they are virtually carbon neutral. And if we can put, if these companies, these big, massive oil companies, can invest in this technology and try and capture this carbon, it's going to be a better world.
So if we put you in the top job, you're in charge at the UN and people are starting to listen to the UN for a change, what would you do?
Well, the problem is, there is, the climate, places that discuss it, but we're sort of, it's 10 years on and we need to do something pretty urgent now. I think we should. The frustrating thing, I think, for the general public and myself, of course, is if you hear all these arguments, and what can one individual do to help the planet? If we all turned off electric lights or we turned down the thermostats, I've been told that if England or Britain, UK, turned off all its power for 1 year, that is just 1 day's consumption in China. So you've got these big tiger economies will be using a lot of power. So how can we influence the rest of the world? And I think if we can invest, as if it was like a war, this is when massive advances in technology always happened. If we can invest masses into renewables and how we reduce this carbon, that's what I would do. I would really invest and encourage these multinationals to invest and give them tax breaks, but also get these tiger economies looking at the how they're producing carbon into the atmosphere.
Irony is, of course, that one of the best ways to stop consumption of oil would be a war in the Middle East.
Yeah, but, blimey. And we all know the arguments of, why we went into Kuwait and Iraq and, I don't know if that's right or wrong, but it certainly makes you cynical when you read about it. I think that maybe somebody... A lot of cynicism there, but that's one of the reasons why we went into Kuwait, to secure our oil. But of course, we've we've nearly used up all our resources, so we've got a lot of gas. And I mean, fracking in this country, again, is carbon. I just think it's worrying.
The one positive thing is, of course, we've had no publicity really for it nationally, hardly any. But there is the tidal power station that they're building up in the north of Scotland now. I was amazed, really. It's the biggest project in the world and really no national coverage for it. I wonder if, you know, the extent of the fossil fuel industry and lobby seems to extend into the press and actually maybe distorting our ability to really see what's going on here.
I think you're absolutely right. I think they're a powerful lobby. I mean, these guys, they go into, they invest lots into PR companies, marketing companies, and they want to get their message either stopped or they want to get the right message across. And, yeah, you know, massive funds. And, of course, you've got politicians on a daily basis being bombarded. I'm just amazed that we just don't seem to get that message out. If you look at Germany, I've flown across Germany in a balloon, and nearly every building's got a solar panel, or they've got solar panels in the garden. There's lots of wind turbines, and we seem to be, you know, so years and years. I can't remember the statistics, but I think it's only something like 10% of our energy is from renewables, and we've got to step it up.
Your boat is north about. It's coming to Bristol any time now. What do you think? What websites or where would you point people to follow some what you consider to be some of the more sensible commentary on climate change?
Well, certainly our site, and ours isn't political in any way, and that's polarocean.co.uk, and the boat will be coming back next Thursday into the port of Bristol. But we set up, and I think, you know, I'm getting a middle-aged man, so, you know, it's the youth of tomorrow which needs to be looking at these things. So we set up a website called Wicked Weather Watch, and that really shows youngsters what's going on. Again, it's not political. It's not. You have to put both sides of the argument, but there's a lot of scientists writing in there, and it sort of directs them to the right areas where to look for this data. So Wicked Weather Watch is a very good site.
Just remind us of your own personal site again.
www.polarocean.co.uk.
Okay, David Templeman-Adams, thanks very much for joining us on Dialect.
My pleasure.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk. UK.
And now I'm joined by Sue Jones. Hi, Sue. Welcome to Dialect.
Hi.
Well, you've been doing a bit of research for us on here. Smartphones are in the news at the moment, with exploding Samsung Note 7s being taken off the market. So let's start with that.
Yeah, well, batteries. The trouble is, it seems, that with smartphones, there's an increasing gap between the phone and the battery. So while phones are getting cleverer and cleverer and cleverer, and they're doubling in capacity every 18 months, the batteries can only double in capacity every 10 years. So they're getting used up much more quickly, which is why we have to charge them every 24 hours. And meanwhile, people still want nice, thin smartphones, so the batteries have to stay very small. So we're trying to pack a huge amount of energy into that small amount of space. And when we charge it, it's very inefficient. So only a third of the electricity actually charges it, and the other two-thirds comes out as heat. So it doesn't surprise me at all that with a few faulty components, bang, it goes up in flames.
Well, there is also the problem of potentially hacking, so that there's complicated electronics inside the smartphone, and these things don't have any kind of antivirus, any anti-hacking protection on them. It could even be possible to interfere with the charging ability of a phone remotely. Is that, do you think?
I don't know. I'm not a complete technical expert.
Okay,
here.
So do you know how smart these actual batteries are? Can they tell when they're getting too hot and switch themselves off?
Well, they're supposed to, yes, but there was faulty components in these, which is why they didn't.
How many smartphones are there in the world at the moment, then?
Well, there are more than 2 billion. So if you've got a population of 7 billion in the world, that's more than a quarter of everybody in the world has got a smartphone.
How about here in Britain?
Two-thirds of people here have got them. That's 40 million out of 60 million people.
Now, what about you? You're one of the people who doesn't have a smartphone.
No, I'm perfectly happy with my old Nokia.
How many days does it stay charged up for?
Oh, a week or so.
Because I know my smartphone, I hate to call them smartphones in a way because they're not so smart really, but you know, it conks out sometimes, you know, halfway through the day. Anyway, how much electricity do these pocket rockets use?
Right, well, what I was going to say to start with is that smartphones are much more than phones. It's a bit of a misnomer. They started off as phones, but now they're also cameras, recorders, wayfinders. You can, you know, go onto Google Maps and find your way around. Contact books, they're like televisions and radios and cinemas. You can do everything with these things, can't you? Play games, access the internet. They're very complicated things. And do you know that every smartphone now has more computer power than NASA used to put a man on the moon all those years ago?
That doesn't surprise me because there was, I think the lunar module was pretty rudimentary computers on there. Anyway, what about the environment? I mean, I would imagine that these things aren't necessarily good for that. There's a lot of raw materials that are dragged out to go into one of these smartphones.
Yeah, well, to start with the electricity that you use for charging them, I thought that would be a lot for smartphones because you have to charge them every night. But actually, it turns out that the amount of electricity you use to charge a smartphone in a year is only the equivalent of 1 hour's driving in an average car in terms of the carbon footprint. So it's not so bad at all in terms of charging. But where it is bad is other things to do with the environment. So when they're made, it uses lots of carbon. So for a start, it's got to use metals from all over the world. So they're taken out, shipped over mostly to China, which is where most of these things are made, and then they're shipped back all over the world. So there's a lot of carbon emissions happening then. And then smartphones, because they're with people all the time, they're the main way now that people use the internet, and as people are walking along, sitting in the bus, whatever, filling up time, people are using the internet so much more than they used to. So it's really driving internet use. It's actually tripled it in 1 year in the 2000s.
Well, because it's so accessible to the internet now. How does it compare to the way we use the internet at home on our desktops and laptops?
Well, it's overtaken it now. More people use the internet through their smartphones than use it through desktops and laptops. It is now the main electronic device. And internet use, we think that our smartphones are nice and clean and efficient and all that sort of thing, but really they're hiding a big dirty secret, because underpinning internet use are these 3 million data centres all over the world, which are enormous warehouses with lots of servers. And when you think that each of us has got lots of emails stored, and we've maybe got lots of pictures and film clips and this and that, and how much all that's increasing, each one of us, and there are more and more and more people getting these accounts, so they have to store huge amounts of data, increasing all the time.
Well, they like that, don't they? Because then they can filch that data, they can get in there and have a look at it and use it. But I mean, you know, people do keep quite a lot at home on their own computers, on their hard drives. How much more are they now keeping then on in the cloud, they call it, don't they, and outside their own home?
I don't know how much more, but what I do know that even 4 years ago, the amount of electricity just to keep the data centres going was enough to fuel 30 nuclear power stations. So, I mean, it's probably doubled or tripled since then. So we're using huge amounts of electricity with our internet searches and everything else.
So not so good for the environment?
No, definitely not so good for the environment.
What about the workers, people making these things?
Yeah, well, the metals that we use in mobile phones, there's such a big demand for phones, and they use tin and cobalt and rare earths, and these places are being really exploited badly. So there's lots of toxic waste happening. So in Mongolia, there's a great big pond where they do the rare earths, and that's all that is starting to leak towards the Yellow River.
What is this rare earth?
Well, rare earths, they're very rare metals that you only find in very small concentrations that are used in mobile phones, in the screens, I think, particularly. There's cobalt from the Democratic Republic of Congo, and that's involved in a lot of conflict. That's called a blood mineral because there's a lot of rebels exploiting it. Using 40,000 children are used in mining in the Congo, and quite a lot to get the cobalt out for mobile phones. And they're paid $1 a day, and children as young as 7. So in all our phones, we think it's all nice and clean, but actually there's a lot of dirty secrets going on behind the scenes.
No, I can remember reading years ago about Apple iPhones being made in China, I think it was, with a horrific under horrific conditions. And of course, you buy this thing in a shop here, you don't have any idea about the whole supply chain that's gone into it, particularly if the environment is being wrecked in the process. But anyway, what about the effects on the health of people actually using these smartphones?
Right, well, smartphones emit radio waves, as you can imagine, which is non-ionising electromagnetic radiation.
Now, what about microwaves? Because we talk about microwave masts, don't we?
Microwave, it's the same type of radiation. Radio waves, television waves, microwaves, and the ones that come to our phones.
Okay, but the microwaves are higher frequency. So that they are actually more damaging. I mean, they can heat you up, for example.
Yes, well, and to a lesser extent, mobile phones heat us up. That is, that the heating effect on our tissues is something that
all right, so you're holding it, the closer you hold it to you, the more it's likely to warm you up with its microwaves.
Yes, and do you know that in the manual of just about every mobile phone, buried deep, deep, deep in the manual, is the instruction to hold the phone at least 10 millimetres away from the body, not to touch your head, your ear with it. But how many of us know about that or even do it?
Well, I can suggest people go online and have a look at a guy called Dr. Barry Trower, T-R-O-W-E-R, and I know Barry Trower has done a fantastic amount of investigation of this. I can remember first coming across him in the 1990s, saying that actually both microwave ovens and the mobile phones that use microwaves, he was saying basically they shouldn't have ever been allowed to be sold to the public because they do have a damaging effect, actually can possibly even cause cancers. So there is that as a possibility. What do you think about that? Is there any record of that?
Well, there's been quite a lot of research now into whether mobile phones are linked with cancer, particularly brain cancers and I think eye cancers. And the jury's out, I have to say, because I looked through the different reports. So
well, what you often find is that one person will say, yes, it does, and then someone else will say, no, it doesn't. And so you're left kind of confused.
Exactly. The big studies haven't shown anything particular. Some of the smaller ones have. But there does seem to be possibly a link between heavy mobile phone use and possibly some brain cancer. But as I say, it's definitely a question mark. But the World Health Organization talks about them having possible carcinogenic effects. So they haven't ruled it out yet. And there's definitely advice to limit children's use.
Okay, what about the effects on our psychological health?
Well, I think that is more worrying altogether. There's lots of studies been done. So for one thing, it spoils concentration. People have done experiments where they've distracted people with emails and texts, and they find it takes 25 minutes on average to get back to the task in hand before you were distracted. So, you know, that's one thing. It affects social interaction. So there was another experiment where they had a stranger come into a room and two people, the person that was there, talked to them. And if there was a phone on the table, even if nothing was happening with it, it was just there, the quality of interaction was much worse than if there was just a notebook on the table. Why? Goodness knows, but the people were less friendly and I don't understand it. But, you know, the other thing is, of course, that it's so much easier to communicate with everybody by email and text, that there's much less face-to-face interaction, much less ringing people up and actually talking to them.
It's funny, isn't it? I mean, sometimes you see people walking down the street and they're actually looking at their phones, looking down with their head down. You wonder if they're going to slam into a lamppost, but actually they're not even looking at the people around them. So there could be two people that maybe know each other well, haven't met for a few years, just pass each other on the street, but they're both staring at their phone, and then so they don't even say hello.
Absolutely. You can have a group of people in a pub sitting around a table and they can all be on their phone. And something else that has been noted is that there are mums taking their children to the park or walking along with the children to school, looking at their phone all the time and hardly talking to the child.
What about the young romantic couple that go out for a Valentine's meal together and spend most of the evening just on their phones without even talking?
Yeah, yeah. There's all sorts of ways that it's damaging social life. There's something called FOMO. Have you heard of FOMO? Fear of missing out. And this is particularly exacerbated by social media, because you read all these things that all your friends are doing and you think, I'm just stuck here on a Saturday night doing nothing. And that makes it worse, and it disrupts sleep because people don't switch it off and they're always, you know.
I do.
Distracted.
Oh, you do. And the other thing is, I've got a friend who's a piano teacher, and she says one of the most difficult things, if she's got a new student, is to convince them that they've got to switch their phone off before they sit down for the piano lesson.
Mm-hmm.
Because some of them just refuse. And, you know, they say, well, no, I can't do that. What happens if, you've got to switch it off. It's part of the deal. If you're going to get a piano lesson from me, you switch your phone off.
Well, they've tried an experiment, the LSE organised it, where they banned it in some schools and the pupils' grades went up. I mean, basically, you know, it's known now as an addiction, isn't it? Smartphone addiction, internet addiction, and people have to detox from it. And when people's phones are taken away from them, they get irritated, anxious, and all that kind of thing.
And you weren't thinking of taking my phone away from me, were you?
I wouldn't dare. Wouldn't dare.
It isn't switched off, actually. It's right next to me here.
I get more anxious if somebody takes my pencil case away than if they take my phone.
I mean, it certainly has changed the way we do things. I mean, for example, in meetings and things like that, you know, you do have to sometimes be there, sitting there ready to, if the phone is on silent, to go and pick up a call, particularly if it's work, something like that. You know, to a certain extent, people phone you now, don't they, expecting that you're going to be ready to answer the call. They're not really considering that you may not be ready to answer the call. One of the things I think is really good to do is just to say, look, is it okay? Is it okay to speak now? You know, and have you got the time to chat?
Exactly, because you've no idea what people are doing the other end.
No. Anyway, you think they cause problems on the roads?
I do, but before we get to the roads, the other thing I didn't mention in terms of psychological health is bullying, of course. I mean, you know, that's another subject in itself. But that is so much worse than it used to be, because there is no escape now. You know, it's not just happening in school for children, but it's happening any time of day or night. And depression, suicides, there were 9 teens killed themselves in 2013 because of bullying on the internet. So there's that whole thing. Then there's another dark side, which is porn, because this is the way that porn is now accessed more than any other, is through smartphones. 60 million visits a day to one site. We're turning into a world of voyeurs, really, and I've heard that the amount of actual sex is going down, and it seems to me that people watching other people having sex is going up.
Well, it's a big industry, isn't it? A lot of money is spent on pornography. What about the moral side of it? How is that going to affect the wider society?
Well, I do worry about the generation that's growing up with this, because they're seeing from the age of 7, 8, 9, I mean, apparently there's a site where men are masturbating and children are watching it on their phones. I mean, and so much of porn, I understand, concerns, like, it's not just nice and friendly and loving. It's nasty and mean.
Doesn't it sort of give young people the wrong idea about actually what sex is about? It's not about love. It's about something, you know, actually kind of exploitative.
Definitely. And a friend told me that one of her daughter's friends said the first time she'd had sex with a boyfriend and they had a nice relationship, and, you know, you'd think, well, that would be a nice thing to do. And at the end, and it was nice, and at the end of it, he spat in her face. Why? Because that's what he'd seen people do on porn sites. And somebody else said, well, the girls always cry on porn sites at the end of sex. You know, I mean, what kind of a... I don't know, it just worries me.
Well, it worries me too. And I think, yeah, just before we leave the subject, you know, it's really about young people, particularly, I can remember as in my mid-teens, you're very vulnerable, you're very impressionable, there's a lot of peer pressure. Mm. And it does seem that if parents and schools aren't doing their job, then young people are getting their sex education via pornography, which just seems to me an absolute diabolical way to go. Anyway, yeah, problems on the roads.
Problems on the roads. 20 deaths a year in Britain because of mobile phone use as people drive cars. And what surprises me is I remember reading in the 1990s that the Road Research Lab had done research and found that people on mobile phones, whether they were holding them or whether they were hands-free, had just as poor reaction times as people who'd drunk alcohol, you know, to the limit when it's illegal. But the government ignored that, you know, for years, and only made it an offence to hold a mobile phone. And they said hands-free is okay. And
but you can chat to your passengers, can't you? Why not?
Well, but the thing is, the person on the other end of a mobile phone conversation might not even know you're driving. They certainly don't know the traffic conditions you're in, but your passenger will see if you're coming to a tricky situation where you've got to concentrate. They're not going to start talking about the most difficult, challenging things, are they? They're going to, for their own...
I suppose you've got two pairs of eyes looking out, but, I mean, the passenger's not in charge of the car, you know. You can't say, well, actually, it's almost like having a co-pilot, you know. The passenger is the driver that should be in charge. So you don't think hands-free is a good idea either?
Well, I'll read you out these. They've done this research again, based at the Transport Research Laboratory. If you're sober, so to the one scenario, it takes 1 second to react to whatever this was, to slow down. If you're at the alcohol limit, it takes 1.2 seconds. If you've got a handheld phone or hands-free, you take slightly more than the alcohol limit, which is just over 1.2 seconds. So it is as dangerous to use a mobile phone, even hands-free in a car, as it is to be at the alcohol limit.
What about people who are actually reading or texting, reading the internet or texting as they're driving?
That's even worse. Texting, it takes 2 seconds to react, so that's twice as long as when you're sober and not...
And by the way, everything except for hands-free is illegal, folks, so do be aware of that.
Yes.
So quite a lot of deaths on the roads because of these things. So that's lots of bad stuff, but we all use them. So what can we do to reduce bad effects of smartphone use?
Right. Well, just a couple of things. One thing is that to reduce the amount of minerals that are being pulled out of the earth and all this child labour and all the rest of that, hold on to your phone for as long as possible. Maybe get a SIM-only contract. Or don't go for the automatic upgrades, because there's not much of a gain these days from one version to the next. So you'll probably be able to do what you want with the phone you've already got. So that saves a lot. The other thing is to make sure that your old phone is recycled, because would you know, there are 85 million unused phones hanging around in our homes in Britain. They contain 4.5 tons of gold. So there's a lot of...
There must be surely an industry in going around collecting them.
Well,
maybe
there
you would have thought there would be, but there isn't.
They should be recycled. They really should. And the other thing is, particularly in terms of phones exploding and all the rest of it, when you charge them, a lot of people put them on overnight, and what I've seen is advised is just to charge them for a couple of hours. Don't try... The old phone, the old batteries used to have memories, and so that you used to have to let them run right down and then charge them right up, like from 0 to 100%. Don't do that with the batteries we have these days. You want to keep them between 20 and 80%. So once you go below 50%, top it up maybe to 80%, but don't go right up to the 100%, and don't let it go right down to the 0%, because both of those, for some reason, are bad for your battery.
Also, talking of batteries, well, we've talked quite a lot about these batteries, but one of the things I've noticed with some smartphones now is the battery is built in. So you can't, say, for example, carry a spare battery in your purse or maybe in your wallet or your pocket. So when that battery runs out, you just pop the old one out and put a new one, and you can't do that with those phones.
Well, there's all sorts of mechanisms to keep us paying more money to the companies, aren't there?
Yeah, and a lot of the reason they do that is because, if you want to replace a battery, then rather than just being able to do it simply, you need to take it back to the shop, and they'll charge you probably 10 times what it would actually cost for the battery. So, and I know iPhones are doing that at the moment. Lots of ways in which they're trying to tie you into spending far more than you need to on your phone. I just wonder, you've made me feel quite guilty about owning a phone, and you are quite happily sitting there with your old Nokia, aren't you?
But today I have spent a whole day on my laptop on the internet researching this spot. So I have used a lot of electricity too. Apologies.
Anyway, Sue Jones, thanks very much for that smartphone report.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Now, Sabine McNeil has been a victim, really, of the police and the courts ever since she started taking up the cause of those who've been abused, sexually abused particularly, and a part of the Child Sex Abuse Inquiry. And Sabine's website is victims-unite.net, plus some others. And so let's hear this week's interview with her now. And she is a little bit restrained about what she can say because of all these court cases she's been wrapped up in.
I'm Sabine McNeil, and I've been trying to do what you've just called, making sure that the British justice system works, as a McKenzie friend, that is a legal advisor. We all also call ourselves public interest advocates. So I've come across oodles and oodles and oodles of cases of victims who have been fraudulently made bankrupt or whose children were taken in secret family courts, and where subsequently the snatch of the children has been legitimized, or if you like, pseudo-legitimized, because at least 80% of the cases of children have been removed under the pretext of future emotional harm.
Now, this is very dangerous, isn't it? Because some people have called it child stealing by the state. Others have called it actually state-sponsored child sexual abuse in some cases. And a lot of kids that have gone to care have found that actually there's not a lot of care there.
Absolutely. I mean, we cover five issues. It starts with child snatching, triggered by generally by social services, and then aided by police. The police are the ones who whose uniform seems to justify the snatch of a child. A Channel 4 report, 1,000 children a month are taken. And I've published statistics how the trend has been consistently rising. The second stage, of course, that facilitates that is the secrecy of the family courts. Then between 4 and 8% of children who are in care actually get adopted against the will of the parents. And then comes the sinister bit of child sexual abuse, which can go as far as ritual abuse and satanic crimes organized in gangs and groups.
Well, this is all pretty worrying stuff. And I know that you've recently been in contact with the Prime Minister and Buckingham Palace to try and get something done.
Yes, as I have been on police bail myself since August 4th last year, I discovered that Paul Gambaccini has suffered a similar fate. He was on police bail of nearly a year. And that was after he exposed Saville on TV.
Okay, so what was that for? What was the background to that?
Well, his exposure of... I wasn't there. I live without television. So I just noticed... I saw that there was a report by the Home Affairs Committee after he appeared before the Home Affairs Select Committee, and subsequently that there was a report produced by the Home Office about the fact that police bail has for 30 years been indefinite. So the police can keep somebody under house arrest for as long as they like and impose the most ridiculous bail conditions.
Well, this is really dangerous. It sounds to me as if people who are trying to blow the whistle are themselves being targeted and victimized by the police.
That's precisely what I have had to discover, and I had to discover that I'm not the only one at all. There is a complete set of statistics available through these reports, and so I put it together as a petition, which I then sent to everybody in the Home Affairs Select Committee, as well as the Petitions Committee, and now recently as a new bundle to the Prime Minister, because I've also emailed 6 times the independent inquiry into child sexual abuse, and what I got back is an automated email that says it's their duty to inform the police. Well, I know for a fact that in my underlying case, the police were at the rock bottom of the cause. So they are clearly not fit for purpose. And that has already been proven by the Royal Commission into New South Wales Police in 1997.
Sorry, that's New South Wales and Australia?
Yeah.
So what happened there?
Well, they produced a report after they had this Royal Commission going, and the results were corruption, paedophilia and satanic ritual abuse as their findings. And the last chair, Dame Goddard, was in touch with that commission as well. But, of course, we don't know exactly why she resigned. And I'm just reminding people that the pattern is the same. It seems to be what was discovered in Australia. It seems to be happening here as well. I don't know whether in Australia they also abuse this police bail situation as badly as I've experienced myself and others like Paul Gambaccini have experienced.
The idea of the national inquiry into historic sexual abuse, we're on our fourth chair now. I think her name is Alexis Kay, who's a former social worker, and also the chief lawyer, Ben Emerson, has recently left. The biggest mystery to me, though, is this Lowell Goddard, the previous chair. I mean, you just now there said that she resigned, but there are also people who are saying that effectively she was bullied out because she was being told that she could not choose which staff were working on this inquiry. Now, let's not forget that the police and the Home Office are actually under investigation, and yet the civil servants were saying to her, you have to take these Home Office staff to run this inquiry. Now, quite clearly, the National Inquiry cannot run when people who are running the inquiry are themselves under investigation.
Yeah, no, I mean, I publish a blog called nationalinquiry.wordpress.com, so I kind of try to keep track, but because I had to look after myself so much more now, I often just reblog items that appear on Researching Reform. And I haven't gone into the details, but I have registered for an event where in November at Lord Chambers wants to spread some insider knowledge about the inquiry.
So if you were one of the people responsible for this at the Home Office, what do you think can be done to actually get the inquiry going in the right direction and actually to get something done in the long term about this state-sponsored paedophilia, effectively?
I have put into my request to the Prime Minister and thus to Her Majesty that I would like, first of all, the Child Sexual Abuse Inquiry to be independent of the police. In other words, they must not have the duty to pass information to the police. Secondly, they should investigate police corruption in a more robust fashion than is currently being done. Thirdly, they should make it mandatory reporting when any civil servant, not just police, are members of secret societies like Freemasons, and they must do what Theresa May did announce, which is to limit police bail.
What about, is there any evidence to link Freemasonry with these child sexual abuse cases?
I only know of what springs to my mind right now is that in 2000, The Guardian published a big picture with lots and lots of policemen as members in the Freemasons. And I found quite a few articles about related to Hillsbury, for example, also that police, especially senior police, are Freemasons. So if you just Google police and Freemason, you will be successful.
Yeah, you'll find that picture. If you Google police, Freemason, Guardian, you'll find that front cover of the Guardian, which is quite amazing. Anyway, where's your website? How can people follow your work, Sabine?
Well, nationalinquiry.wordpress.com is this particular one, but the most popular one is victims-unite.net.
Okay, Sabine McNeil, good luck in all you do. Bless you. Thanks very much for joining us again on Dialect.
Thank you for keeping your interest, Tony.
That's all for this week, Dialect's Bristol's first weekly MP3 podcast. If you're online, you can subscribe to our emails or download the podcast from Dialect Radio, one word, .co.uk. Thanks to our guests, David Hempelman Adams, from his ship and boat, actually call it a boat, the Northabout. Also to Sue Jones for her report, How Smart Are Smartphones? And finally, you just heard Sabine McNeil there, whistleblower turned into criminal. Dialect is a Bristol Broadband Co-op production. Catch us on Bristol Community FM 93.2 every Tuesday at noon. And anyone can contribute. Contact us through the People's Republic of Stokes Croft, just off Jamaica Street, on 0117 909 6897 or prsc.org.uk. Also via Volunteering Bristol on 0117 989 7733. Online, one word, volunteerbristol.org.uk. Or the national volunteering site is do-it.org. That was Dialect, and I'm Tony Gosling. Wishing you a very good week. Thanks for listening. Till the same time next week. Goodbye for now. Cross maker.
Thank you.